Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be talking about ethics, thought to be derived from ethos, the Greek word for character or custom. And we'll be playing the Ethics Bowl, a competition in which philosophy students on the UALR Ethics Bowl team discuss an ethical case, a case whose content may range from the social to the political. Last year, the UALR Ethics Bowl team placed 16th in the National Intercollegiate Ethics Bowl competition and earned 4th place at the Texas Regional Ethics Bowl in San Antonio, Texas this year. Arts and Letters and Ethics, up next, but first, this.
You can teach almost any student to come up with a very interesting concept, a very interesting idea, but if you can't make the object, the project stops. It's hard to tell someone that now you're going to spend a week with a piece of sandpaper and perfect this. It's kind of mind-numbing to do it, but it's this enjoyment you get through working with your hands. You have hundreds of new aspiring artists every year, and you get to make your own art. It's hard to beat. This is Mia Hall. I'm an associate professor of art at UALR, teach furniture design, and you're listening to 89.1 KUAR.
For the University of Arkansas at Little Rock, I'm Associate Dean J. Bradley Minnick, and welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for the celebration of the arts, humanities, and social sciences at UALR. The Intercollegiate Ethics Bowl competition was created by Illinois Institute of Technology professor Dr. Robert Landerson in 1993. According to Landerson, the Ethics Bowl is an activity that combines a valuable and distinctive educational experience for students with excitement and fun of competitive games. In order to help us navigate through the ethical considerations of this competition and educational experience, we've invited UALR philosophy professors and founders and advisors to the Ethics Bowl team here at UALR, Dr. Rochelle Green and Dr. Allison Merrick. Also joining us are Dr. Michael Norton, Assistant Professor of Philosophy and Religious Studies, and Dr. Jason Fischel, Visiting Instructor in Philosophy. Later, we'll be joined by two students who will compete against each other and discuss their experiences on the Ethics Bowl team at UALR. Ethicists, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Great to be here.
The Markela Center for Applied Ethics at Santa Clara University poses the following. Some years ago, sociologist Raymond Baumhart asked business people, what does ethics mean to you? Among their replies were the following.
Ethics has to do with what my feelings tell me is right or wrong.
Ethics has to do with my religious beliefs.
Being ethical is doing what the law requires.
Ethics consists of the standards of behavior our society accepts.
Dr. Rochelle Green teaches philosophy at UALR. Dr. Green, what is ethics?
Ethics is generally understood to be a branch of philosophy which investigates theories of proper behavior and conduct. In effect, the branch of ethics also seeks to answer questions like, how ought I act? Specific ethical questions that we may be more familiar with would include things like, should we go to war? Is violence ever justifiable? Is it ethical to lie in order to save a life? How ought we treat non-human animals? There are an unlimited number of ethical questions, and as you can see, we confront these kinds of ethical questions every day in a number of different circumstances.
How does this definition apply to contemporary studies in philosophy?
Contemporary philosophers are engaging in an increasingly wide swath of ethical issues, and these can range from meta-ethical questions, which involve making theories about ethical systems, to concrete concerns specific to our historical moment. Philosophers trained in meta-ethics seek to generate the best theoretical framework to enable us to consistently and fairly answer the myriad questions we face. Philosophers focusing on specific questions will often specialize and work with professionals in other areas. So, for example, philosophers interested in medical ethics often work at hospitals or in medical facilities. And similarly, philosophers may be employed by corporations to enable them to work through environmental and business-related concerns.
Dr. Merrick teaches philosophy at UALR as well. Dr. Merrick, what's the relevance of ethics to professions like medicine and business?
I think this is a very timely question. We're facing increasing concerns with regard to technological advances in the domain of medicine. So, for instance, we might consider the ever-advancing field of genetics. The Human Genome Project is increasingly allowing us to pinpoint the smallest details of a person's genetic makeup. This allows us to see abnormalities before they become manifest. So we may ask global questions about whether it's ethical to disclose to children that they have an increased risk for developing a particular disease, or more local questions, like whether it's ethical for parents to have a child, knowing the child may be at greater risk.
Dr. Norton is a philosophy and religious studies professor here at UALR. Dr. Norton, what's the intersection, if any, between ethics and morals?
Well, standards are particularly important when we recognize the intersection between individuals and society. Based on the original Greek word ethos, which can mean custom in addition to character, we can see how there is an inherent concern for how social bodies or institutions, as well as individuals, behave and what they value. Ethics is often described as concentrating on questions of value among groups, institutions, or society. Morals we sometimes think of as values more deeply embedded within individuals or specific groups. So when we discuss morality, we often think more specifically about what a particular individual or particular group values, as opposed to reconciling such values with a larger community or society as a whole. Of course, these are rough definitions and aren't always used to refer to such distinct subjects. Often people use the terms interchangeably.
I like to think that ethical problems are best found at the intersection of competing goods. To see this, we can consider a dilemma that a legislative body might have in considering the allocation of resources. In this example, the legislators face a problem. It's good to fund local schools, and it's good to fund public highways. So the dilemma, or ethical problem, is how to negotiate between competing goods.
One way pedagogically of instructing students on ethical problems is by using a case-based approach to learning. That is, providing an ethical dilemma for students and having them work through issues and problems posed by it. For instance, students might work through ethical cases on voting rights, the death penalty, gun control, or Facebook. Dr. Merrick, could you read us a case? And Dr. Norton, could you then take us through some of its issues and ethical implications?
Here's the case. Sorry.
Good.
All right. Here's the case, entitled Lifesavers, taken from a set of 2012-2013 regional qualifying high school ethics bowl cases. When we picture the beach in the summer, we see swimmers, sunbathers, kids playing in the sand, and a long line of lifeguard towers. What we probably don't know is that the companies that staff these lifeguard towers have rules about under what circumstances lifeguards can save lives. For example, a company in South Florida forbids lifeguards from leaving their post to attend to swimmers in the water outside of the designated company zone. If alerted to an incident outside of the company's zone of protection, lifeguards are instructed to call 911. However, in July of 2012, a lifeguard noticed a drowning man about 1,500 feet outside of his zone and sprang into action. By the time the lifeguard reached the victim had already turned blue.
Even though the lifeguard secured his post while he rescued the victim, the company fired the lifeguard almost immediately. Three lifeguards quit out of protest, and two were fired for stating that they would have done the same thing. The company later agreed to hire them all back, although it defended its actions, citing liability issues. According to the company, the contract that it offers its employees is to protect a certain area, and if they leave that area, they're no longer doing their jobs. Furthermore, the unprotected area is clearly marked with signs warning swimmers to swim at their own risk.
Dr. Norton, how would one respond to a case like this?
Well, this case is rich. One of the central ethical questions is, should a company policy forbid lifeguards from helping people outside of the designated area? And no doubt reasonable people might disagree about how best to answer this question. I mean, on the one hand, the company might reasonably contend that they only have an obligation to swimmers in the designated zones. Such an obligation might be cast out in a couple of different ways. First, the company might suggest that they're contractually obligated to protect swimmers in the designated areas, and as such, their responsibility to swimmers is limited by that contract. Secondly, the company might appeal to the idea that protecting all swimmers is a conceptual implausibility. There are just too many people to protect. That is, does it make conceptual sense to say the company would then be morally responsible for all swimmers? Well, no. The absurdity of that is just on the face of it. On the other hand, defenders of the lifeguard's position might say that those that hold such a post have a duty to protect all swimmers. That is, part of what it means to be a lifeguard is to save the most number of swimmers that one can, even if the swimmers are located outside of one's area. We can take these two thoughts and put them together. The lifeguard is obligated to help all swimmers out of a professional responsibility, which also maximizes the good by saving all those that are in the proximity of the lifeguard. So we can see from this brief analysis the ways in which reasonable people might disagree about what is the right course of action in this case. How does that synthesis sound to y'all?
Well, I think this case definitely presents us with sort of competing goods that Dr. Merrick talked about before. Because on the one hand, as you mentioned, we have these professional responsibilities. But then on the other hand, we have issues where we think of lifeguards as having a moral obligation to save people, regardless of what kind of contract their employer may have given the space of a particular area. And so I think part of what is interesting about this case is really the extent to which we're going to honor professional contracts or professional obligations above and beyond what we think are just basic human duties or human obligations are. So I'll jump in and take a stand here and say I think the lifeguard probably should have to save anyone that that lifeguard sees flailing about and in need of help, regardless of the contract that their employer has.
I don't know if I agree, because in order to maximize the good, it might be the case that they have to uphold the contract despite there being some negative consequences some of the time. So if I'm a lifeguard and I go find somebody and save them who's drowning 1,500 feet or yards away, I'm also further away from the other side of my area. And so I won't be able to find somebody who's within my area that other lifeguards might not be looking at. So in order to maximize the good, even though sometimes there are negative consequences, the contracts might be set up such that the greater good is served by honoring them.
I think you make a really interesting point here. However, it may also be the case that we have an obligation to help any human being in need, particularly if we have special training. So if I were to disregard those spatial limitations set forth only by my employer and try to save a life, try to save someone that I see flailing about, I'm actually respecting the dignity of that life. If I were to ignore that and just proceed with my allotted spatial requirements, I may be in a situation where I actually watch that person die when I could have prevented that death.
I also think it's worth thinking more about the idea that protecting all swimmers for any one lifeguard or really for any group of lifeguards is still going to be a practical or conceptual impossibility, or at least, as I put it, an implausibility, something that is hard to imagine actually being done. So given that kind of constraint that we are under just sort of by the laws of nature, can we hold the lifeguard to be obliged, to have a duty to save everyone who needs saving? Because it is plausible to think that there might at one time be two competing goods, as Dr. Merrick explained earlier, two people who need saving at the same time and who can't both be saved by the same lifeguard.
I wonder if Dr. Norton isn't committing something of a slippery slope, right? So the idea here isn't that the lifeguard's got to save all people, but rather the lifeguard's got to save people that the lifeguard can see and is able to save. So I wonder if in this case, given the footage, the lifeguard isn't morally obligated. Sure, he doesn't, or she, isn't obligated to save each and every person, but certainly the people within their sphere of influence.
You are listening to KUAR, and we're talking to the faculty and students about the Ethics Bowl at UALR.
Okay, it's kind of getting hot in here, these philosophers, and crowded. And we have two students from the UALR Ethics Bowl team, Angela Johnson and Marla Cole. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Angela, tell us a little bit about yourself and your experiences with the Ethics Bowl.
I am currently a senior philosophy and psychology double major. I've been a part of the Ethics Bowl team since Dr. Merrick and Dr. Green first started the team in 2011. I've always been interested in the ways that human beings respond to compromising and oftentimes difficult situations. I think that there's a great cross-section between psychological and philosophical ideas, especially when discussing different types of ethical dilemmas.
I hear you've been invited to participate in the Oxford University workshop on human rights in England.
Yes.
How's your experience with the Ethics Bowl helped you approach applying for and preparing for these types of programs?
Well, Ethics Bowl has given me a great deal of confidence, and it's helped me cultivate certain professional skills that are really essential when preparing to study at places like Oxford University or even to prepare for my graduate work.
In this corner, we have Marla Cole. Marla is a junior
and a double major in philosophy and biology. Marla, what's the most important lesson you've learned from being on the Ethics Bowl team?
Ethics Bowl has given me a lot of professional experience. I've learned about public speaking, about engaging with judges and people in positions of authority. And perhaps most importantly, I've learned ways of disagreeing with people politely about controversial issues.
How have your experiences with the Ethics Bowl team helped your current studies?
I think being a part of the Ethics Bowl team has really helped me keep focused on my schoolwork and has also provided me with quite a bit of practice using critical thinking skills, which are applicable in every field and in all aspects of life. Most importantly, though, I'll take with me a better ability to communicate and to discuss complicated issues with people and hear all sides and differing perspectives. Traveling with the team is a great bonding experience, and you just learn a lot about the people that you're kind of thrust in this competitive situation with, and you just grow as a team. You just become closer.
So we're going to start our competition. Are we ready?
Yeah.
Yes? Yeah. All right. So today, Dr. Norton will act as the moderator, and he often acts as the moderator for these competitions. Are we ready to go?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay.
Let me briefly explain how these competitions go. First, a case is picked for the two teams or individuals competing. Today, Dr. Green will read through the case that we've chosen. Then the competitors will be asked a question by the judges. One side will offer an answer to that question. After that, the other side will have a chance to briefly rebut that answer. We'll have a couple of questions from our judges, Dr. Green and Dr. Merrick, and then Jason Fischel will offer some summary and commentary afterwards. So, Dr. Green, would you like to read our case?
Sure. Here's a case entitled Academic Integrity, and this case is taken from the set of 2012-2013 Regional Qualifying High School Ethics Bowl cases. Cheating is defined as acting dishonestly or unfairly in order to gain an advantage. However, many American children and young adults seem to think of cheating as normal, if not acceptable, action towards gaining a desired result. Cheaters are not predominantly low-scoring, below-average students. The majority of high school cheaters today are actually high-performing, college-bound students. And they aren't necessarily only cheating on tests. A recent study found that while 22% of students reported having cheated at least once on a test, 43% admit to providing or receiving unauthorized collaboration on homework. Unauthorized collaboration at the university level is also highly prevalent, sparking a dialogue about what constitutes cheating. Some students even argue that they should be allowed to collaborate. After all, in the postgraduate workplace, people are often encouraged to work together to maximize their resources. So given that case, here's an ethical question to consider. Under what conditions, if any, is cheating morally permissible?
Angela, you won the coin toss. It's your turn to answer.
Okay. Thank you for a great question. I would like to begin my argument by saying that cheating under any circumstances would be morally impermissible. I would like to first make this point by going through Aristotelian virtue ethics, which gives us our virtue, which is the mean point between two vices, one being in deficiency and the other being in excess. The virtue that we would like to look at here is honesty. And the vice of excess would be rigid honesty, which is the unwillingness to bend the truth even a little bit. And the vice of deficiency would be that of being dishonest. And dishonesty would be the lack of being able to tell the truth under any circumstances. So we would like to zone in and make the key virtue that the person in this case should have being that of honesty, which is being able to tell the truth in the right way, at the right time, and in the exactly right amount. So the conclusion that we draw from this is that the virtuous person would be one who acts in honesty in most circumstances, given that it's the right way, right time, and in the right amount. And so they wouldn't engage in cheating because to do so would be having them act in accordance to a vice, which is dishonesty. So that virtuous person under any circumstances would not consider cheating, and therefore we draw that cheating would be an impermissible act.
All right. Thank you for your answer. Marla, now it's your turn to respond.
Thanks, Angela, for a very thoughtful
argument. And I'd like to say that I agree with you. Cheating is morally impermissible. However, I have a different argument to be made, a different ethical theory I would use, which would be a deontological theory. And basically, the maxim must be universalized. And this maxim would be cheating. Could cheating be universalized? Could you say that every student is able to cheat on every assignment? No, you can clearly see that that couldn't be universalized because that would undermine the very basis of the educational system. So therefore, the act of cheating is morally impermissible. I agree with you.
Thank you very much for your response. Let me hand it off to Dr. Merrick.
First, I'd like to say I think you both presented some really good arguments against cheating. But I wonder if we can apply your arguments to the notion of unauthorized collaboration. So when Dr. Green presented the case, the students suggested that unauthorized collaboration is useful because, hey, I'm going to have to collaborate with colleagues when I get out into the workforce. So unauthorized collaboration is really just preparing me for my job, right? Do you agree with them?
I think this question is something of a red herring, actually. That is, read in one way, unauthorized collaboration is cheating, which is an attempt to gain an unfair advantage. So I would argue that the same argument holds for both.
I agree with Mimi. If the student really values collaboration and thinks that this is a value that their future employer will require, then they should speak with their professor or their teachers prior to such collaborations. I'm sure that on some assignments that the professor would be okay with letting the students collaborate with each other. And it's a nice solution that allows the students to both maintain their academic integrity and also acquire those additional skills that collaboration would offer.
I remember being in contexts as a student where I would study with other students. And I remember in particular studying philosophy, which is extraordinarily difficult, and having my fellow students help me read through passages that were really dense and very difficult. And we would work together to come up with interpretations of text. Now, that wasn't on a test. We were just working together as study groups. Nonetheless, I think I probably learned quite a lot from my fellow students in those contexts. Does that count as unauthorized collaboration?
Well, I don't think in the context of having other students help you learn as being the same thing as unauthorized collaboration. I feel that it's totally okay for you to engage with other students and have that sounding board, as they were, to help you understand the information that you wouldn't normally be able to pick up on your own.
The student knows it's wrong, which is why it's unauthorized. It's not something that you say, well, hey, professor, we're going to go and do this on this test. No, you do it in secret because you know that it's using someone else to your advantage, or, you know, you're helping someone else that didn't do the work, or, you know, you're being taken advantage of, essentially, by doing that. So I don't think that studying in a group is necessarily unauthorized collaboration, and that the boundary kind of comes in what you would share with your professor that you're actually doing. I think you would share with the professor, we're going to go study as a group, and that wouldn't be a problem. But for us to go work on this test as a group, that would probably be a big deal as
Thanks.
Far as that goes.
That's helpful.
So this is the point after the judges' questions where a normal competition would come to an end and scores would be tallied. Professor Fischel, what do you think about the questions and answers that we just heard?
Well, one of the ways that this differs from a debate that is really illustrated quite well in the conversation that we just had is where the ethical analysis given by one student looks at, especially the one given by Angela, for instance, it looks at two different ethical dimensions of our case, one being the virtue theoretical position and one being the utilitarian position, which is ultimately refuted. One of the strong points of Marla's evaluation of Angela's answer was that Marla pulled off of a Kantian kind of deontological argument to question whether or not the virtue theoretical stance that Angela put forth really held enough water to be an overriding argument. So what they're doing is they're putting these different ethical theories into conversation with one another to try and figure out what the best one might be among all the competing answers that we might have for a very complex issue.
I think it's also interesting to see something like what Angela mentioned when she brought up a possible disagreement with her point based on a utilitarian argument that would say something like Well, if the ends justify the means, which is a sort of oversimplified way of presenting what utilitarianism says, then perhaps the end of a good grade or passing a class justifies cheating on a test. But Angela was able to turn that around and say, well, no, actually, when you apply that same utilitarian argument, in the long run, cheating ends up producing a worse result. So even from strictly utilitarian grounds, the best utilitarian argument is one against cheating.
So across her entire presentation, Angela remained true to a constant thesis point, regardless of the specific theories she was using or considering. She also remained relevant. She didn't bring in extra information that wouldn't directly bear on the question of whether or not cheating could be morally permissible. So she maintained a kind of relevancy. Similarly, with Marla's response to Angela, she maintained consistency in her position. She was able to agree with Angela, but further the argument without contradicting herself. And both of them maintained that throughout the judges' questions. So again, they didn't contradict themselves when judges were asking them questions, and they were able to further elaborate their positions.
I'm Jay Bradley Minnick, and you are listening to Arts and Letters on KUAR 89.1. Well, I thought that was wonderful. Thanks, Marla and Angela. The philosophy department offers courses in ethics. Dr. Merrick, what might one expect from such a course?
So we have a lot of classes that deal with ethics, and we can create a specific degree plan allowing students to maximize their credit hours in ethics. Our introductory ethics course is called Ethics in Society, and it focuses on all the major ethical theories in the history of philosophy. This class also satisfies the requirement for the university. So if you're interested but not sure about declaring a major in philosophy, although you should be, but if you're not sure, this class is available and will satisfy requirements for graduation.
I know the philosophy department's provided opportunities for a high school ethics bowl competition, of which I was proud to be a judge last year and hope to be one this year. Dr. Green, could you tell us a little bit about the high school ethics bowl?
Sure, I'd be happy to. The Arkansas State Regional High School Ethics Bowl will be held on January 25th, so it's coming up here, from 8 a.m. to 3:30 p.m., and that'll be held on the UALR campus. Any regional high schools are eligible to participate. Ethics Bowl teams at the high school level must have a minimum of 3 students and 1 teacher, the teacher serving as coach. Further details, if you're interested, are available on our website. And alternatively, you can also call the Department of Philosophy and Interdisciplinary Studies. If you're interested in calling, you can reach us at 501-569-3312.
And if people want to judge for events, or if any of the teachers want to judge for events, I know that there are people lining up to be judges.
Absolutely.
Including associate deans from several colleges, as well as community members.
It sounds like your second.
That's right.
Well, worry not. Your invitation is in the mail. We are always looking for good judges. And similarly, you can call us at the phone number I gave previously.
I understand that you want to throw down an ethical gauntlet to KUAR audience members. Would you tell us what you are asking of them?
Absolutely. We'd like to challenge the very talented KUAR audience members to find a topic for a case for our UALR Ethics Bowl team to consider. Submission should highlight a specific ethical question or dilemma and reference a current event or issue. So again, email your submissions to our Philosophy and Interdisciplinary Studies Department, and the top 5 topics will receive a small token of our appreciation.
Well, thank you so much, everyone, for being here. You've been terrific.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks very much. It's been a blast.
Thank you.
Broadcast from the University District, this has been a special program on KUAR 89.1. Thanks for joining us. Arts and Letters and other programming that airs on this station can be found at KUAR.org. Leave us a comment there and let us know what you thought about the program. On behalf of the College of Arts, Humanities, and Social Sciences, Drs. Rochelle Green, Allison Merrick, Michael Norton, Jason Fischel, and UALR philosophy students Angela Johnson and Marla Cole, I'd like to thank Lauren and Micah Sukany, whose band supplied the music. Kudos to our producer, Master Flash, Christopher Hickey. For the College of Arts, Humanities, and Social Sciences, I'm Jay Bradley Minnick, and I'd like to end this discussion of ethics with a quotation by Professor Cornel West, who said,
"Takes tremendous discipline, takes a minute, tremendous courage to think for yourself, to examine yourself. Courage to think critically. You can't talk. Courage is the enabling virtue for any philosopher, for any human being, I think, in the end. Courage to think, courage to love, courage to hope."